Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Evangelical Christians have been a major voting bloc for nearly three decades in America, and today's religious right owes much of its power to the late Francis Schaeffer, an American who rose to global prominence from a ministry headquartered in La Brie, Switzerland. That extraordinary influence helps explain the reception his son Frank Schaeffer received when he decided to commit himself to ending abortion in the United States. American Christians who idolized Francis Schaeffer welcomed Frank Schaeffer and his ideas for what was, in the late 70s, largely considered a Catholic political issue. Soon the Schaeffers had allies, including Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and the rallying cry against abortion pulled together millions of American Christians into today's religious right. But if he could do it all over again, Frank Schaeffer says he would do things very differently. The explanation comes in his new memoir, Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. Frank, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
You write, "We Americans like to think of ourselves as good. This national delusion is our real religion." What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I go on in the book to talk about how the French all think they can cook and know everything about wine, and we're kind of like that with our American exceptionalism of assuming that somehow we are better and more enlightened morally than other people. And so when we look at national issues, whether it's abortion or prison conditions or capital punishment or just how our political system works, we always have this kind of aura of sanctimony under what we're saying. And one of the results of that is that we're all sure we're completely right, so that when someone else is wrong and we disagree with them, we tend to demonize our opponents, whether we're from the left or the right. So in that sense, we've really continued, I think, the inheritance that we first got from our Puritan forefathers, where, you know, they came from Britain to be a city set on a hill, and that spirit has animated American culture ever since. We're very sure we're right, and we're sure we're good.
Well, and when you say that, you refer to all Americans, but you also talk about particularly evangelicals. When they argue with someone on a matter of theology, it's not a matter, you write, of simply saying this person's on the wrong side of an issue. You say that many of them assume that the other person is on the wrong side of God.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of a certainty that comes from a type of fundamentalism, whether it's, you know, Al-Qaeda striping bombs on people to blow up women and children they disagree with because they're, you know, on the wrong side of the Shiite-Sunni divide, or whether it's a type of American evangelical fundamentalism that isn't killing anybody right now, but definitely has a viewpoint that other people are not simply mistaken, but that they are evil and that God hates them. And when you see the kind of rhetoric that carries on in the name of Christianity sometimes about gay people, or if you look at the way politics developed out of the 70s and 80s that my dad and I were part of, that began to really polarize this country into this red and blue state phenomenon, you see some of that. And I think what really happened there was that you had a political movement that came out of the religious right that started out for a few simple issues, such as standing up for human life against abortion after Roe v. Wade, this kind of thing. But then really what emerged from that was kind of a separate nation that really saw itself as different and better than other Americans. And so you had a whole alternative culture, Christian, quote-unquote, television, schools, homeschooling, curricula, a kind of a real separation from the rest of the culture. So now, you know, we're not only divided along the red state, blue state fracture, there's also a religious America that sees itself as entirely separate and opposed to the rest of this country. And I think that that's an unintended consequence that came out of some of the things my dad and I were doing in the 70s and the early 80s, you know, that, as you said in your introduction, I look back on with tremendous regret.
Well, when you talk about unintentional consequences, the early working subtitle of your book was How I Helped Found the Religious Right and Ruin America. Was right. The change of the title your idea, or was it your publisher's?
No, that was the publisher's. You know, they stuck with my original title, Crazy for God. Everybody liked that. And then, of course, a subtitle is meant to be as descriptive as possible and sum up the book in a way that will draw people in. And they thought that subtitle was just too confrontational in the sense that it was a little bit stark, and they felt that the book is somewhat more nuanced than that, and I think it is. I mean, the book is about all sorts of things. It's not just about American politics or the religious right. It's also about my childhood in Switzerland at the community of Le Brie, days in British boarding schools, my ups and downs in the movie business as a writer, you know, that's produced books like Portofino and other novels. So there is more in there than that, and they just wanted that subtitle to reflect that.
And we'll get more into to your personal transformation as we go on. We should point out now, though, just so that people understand, you are still a Christian. You are a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, one of the problems with coming out of that fundamentalist evangelical background is it's so exclusionary in terms of anybody who's not part of that specific movement that even the term, like Christian, has now become a generic term, even in the secular media, for evangelicals. And, of course, this is ridiculous because the term Christian involves Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholics, Syrian Catholics, all kinds of different Protestants that don't regard themselves as evangelical, all sorts of individual believers that don't go to any church at all. And in that wide sense, I'm a Christian, but I'm certainly no longer an evangelical by any stretch of the imagination.
You write, "Some people literally worshipped my parents." How was that evident to you?
Well, it's not an unusual phenomenon. We live in a celebrity-oriented and celebrity-driven culture, and there are plenty of people worshipping rock stars and movie stars and other people as well. It isn't related only to the evangelical phenomenon. I think what's weird about it is not the celebrity culture that we live in, but what's strange is when you're in the business of selling God, as it were, and that is the family business, to then have groupies who kind of follow the family. Actually, it was in Dallas. I was at a seminar there talking to Roger Staubach backstage when we had 16,000 people coming out from my movie series, How Should We Then Live, that I produced and partly directed with my dad. And I remember Roger was standing there. A lady came up to me and said, "I want to shake your dad's hand." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry. Dad just left to go back to the hotel. He's not feeling well," which was just what happened. And she suddenly grabbed my hand and pressed it and said, "Well, that way I get to at least say I touched a Schaefer." And that kind of thing was not unusual and goes on all the time in evangelical circles. And as I point out in Crazy for God, I think what a lot of people don't understand and others who do are sort of turned off by is this not only celebrity culture, but this bizarre individual kind of following people have. And in the case of some of the televangelists, you know, people like Benny Hinn and others, you know, you have people so psychologically keyed up that when they go to his rallies, you know, if he even points in their direction, they all fall down, so-called slain in the spirit, one of these charismatic phenomena in that branch of the church. You know, this borders on some kind of lunacy. And really, you know, we weren't in that charismatic type of Christian circle where you get these manifestations. But, you know, I experienced a fair share of that kind of craziness. And, of course, in the feedback to Crazy for God, this book that I'm getting, there's a lot of folks who seem to appreciate it in the sense of telling the story of our family from my point of view and the humanizing effect that might have in, you know, looking at my dad, Francis Schaefer, my mother, Edith Schaefer, and the phenomena of Le Brie. But there's other people who feel that, you know, if you don't hold up my parents as perfect human beings, if you dare to say they may have weaknesses or been human like everybody else, that somehow, you know, it almost borders on blasphemy. And, of course, this is kind of insane and comes out when you get people asking me, "Well, why did you write the book?" And the simple answer is, you know, I'm a writer, and this is my 10th book since I left the evangelical circles. I've written 4 books on being a Marine father, like Keeping Faith, a father-son story about love in the United States Marine Corps, that have nothing to do with this subject. You know, if I'd been raised in a steel town like Pittsburgh and my dad had been a foreman in a factory, that's where I'd be setting my memoir. So it isn't that I chose this material because I have something to, quote, say to former or evangelical Christians. It's simply that was the milieu in which I was raised, and so naturally that's what I write about, because writers write about their lives and what they know about.
Did you actually feel, though, at points in your life as though you had been specially chosen and that you did have either that reflected glory or that you had a better sense of what God wanted for you than the average person?
Well, our whole family did. I mean, if you read my mother's book, Le Brie, the story of our work, you know, it was a series of quote-unquote miracles that chose us out. You know, it's odd when you grow up as a child. In my novel, Portofino, which was the first book I wrote after I left the evangelical circles, and that, you know, thankfully got good critical and reception and has done well since.
But, and it's semi-autobiographical.
And semi-autobiographical. Mm-hmm. I have Calvin Becker, who's the little boy in the story at 11 years old, you know, in the book, which is told in his voice, as is the rest of the Calvin Becker trilogy, Zermatt and Saving Grammuck. He says at one point, some boys told lies to be special. I told lies to be normal. And really, you know, when you have a mother who's telling you that God has chosen your family to be a living example of his existence, and that everybody who comes to the ministry will be looking at you to decide their eternal fate based on how you behave, how you treat them, how you quote-unquote witness to them. You know, you talk about stage moms putting pressure on little boys and girls to look good for the audition for the Breck commercial or whatever it is. That ain't nothing compared to having the weight of other people's salvation on your shoulders based on whether you're a good witness or not. And it's a kind of a craziness. So, you know, somebody asked me the other day when I did this reading for Book TV on C-SPAN that was on last weekend, you know, there was a question saying, how did you come up with the title Crazy for God? And I said, well, you know, the title means several things. And one is literally that I was driven crazy by God in the sense that this burden of proof that's put on evangelical and fundamentalist children to be a, quote, good witness and people's eternal salvation or damnation hinges on this. You know, if it wasn't for the fact that we just accept as, quote, normal a religious kind of view here in this country, people would see it for what it is, which is just kind of a form of insanity. It really is craziness. And then, of course, Crazy for God also has this kind of double meaning of still worrying about and being crazy for, in the slang section as a sense, the idea of God and worrying about whether God exists and this journey of faith, which is a whole different question. But the actual craziness comes in terms of the pressure that I talk about in the book of growing up in a home where the fate of others or the fate of the world, the fate of eternal destinies for people's souls depend on you. And that, of course, is very weirdly combined with this fatalistic Calvinist theology I grew up with that, on the other hand, says, well, look, everything depends on you, but on the in another sense, since God has foreordained everything, you're not in charge of anything. You really don't even have free will. Everything is according to God's will. And so this kind of tension, you know, other kids thinking about baseball cards and their first date, and, you know, I was growing up in the middle of a family that was worrying about eternal destinies on one hand and balancing free will and predestination on the other, not exactly what you would call kind of carefree, light environment.
You thought, as a seven-year-old coping with polio that crippled one of your legs for a time, thought maybe that was because God was angry with your father.
Yes, I got that idea because my mother, who would sort of lord it over my dad, she came from this aristocratic blue blood background, you know, her great-great-great whatever was second mate on the second voyage of the Mayflower. Her parents were scholars and went to China in a mission in the late 19th century, early 20th century. She was born and lived in China till she was six and then came back. You know, my dad came from this grinding working class poor family in Philadelphia, second generation German immigrants and so forth, and got quote unquote saved when he was older rather than growing up in a Christian home. So all through my childhood, my mom would say, well, you know, your dad's from working class parents, or he never was a Christian when he grew up, so he doesn't know how these things could go or should go. And I guess, you know, the way it all came out was that, you know, I had this feeling that everything depended on her good behavior and prayers being answered. And then one of the things she would talk about was how Dad had this, quote, period of doubt. And I think it was 1949 or 1950, when for about 6 months he decided God didn't exist. And he went through a very kind of bleak period. And, you know, I always thought, well, maybe his period of doubt had resulted somehow in him being punished through me and my polio, which was an odd idea. But she never said it outright, but it goes to show what kids pick up.
Author Frank Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called Crazy for God. After the break, we will talk to Frank about what changed in the dynamic of the family and in his own life when his girlfriend, now his wife, became pregnant as a teenager. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults, offering gift certificates for anyone on your list who loves the arts, languages, writing, history, or travel. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Frank Schaefer. He is the son of Edith and Francis Schaefer. His new book is called Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Frank, at what point did you start to sense that your parents were different people privately, dealing with each other and with you as children, from what they projected publicly?
I think I sensed a difference from a very early age. I think I began to notice, for instance, when we went to our vacations in Italy in Portofino, which, by the way, in those days was the inexpensive place to vacation if you lived in Switzerland. You just hopped on a train, went 3 or 4 hours, and then were there, and the exchange rate was great, so even penniless missionaries could afford this, but couldn't anymore, by the way. It's expensive now. But when we would be down there, my mom and dad, especially my dad, seemed so much happier than when he was in the mission. And, you know, when we would visit art museums, which was always his love because he had this tremendous interest in culture and art and history, but especially art, you know, all of a sudden, you know, no more talk about God or the Bible or the ministry or praying for income to Labrie and all kinds of interests in the Renaissance and Michelangelo and Leonardo and Fra Angelico and how all this worked. And all of a sudden, it was as if he was in his element. And so I never really thought about it, but I used to get a very heavy kind of sinking feeling when we would get back on that train and head for Labrie, not just because the vacation was over, but because, you know, that's when my parents were going to start fighting again. That was the part of my life that I sort of dreaded in some ways, because it was back to the professional Christian grind where we were living in a fishbowl in Labrie in front of all kinds of people upon whose, you know, eternal destiny our witness depended. I think my dad was not suited to this. He was a very private man. He would just go up to his room and turn up his record player and play classical music 24/7, full blast, while my mom was downstairs preparing meals in the kitchen for 30 or 40 people who were the guests in the house. He would kind of race from his bedroom to the lecture hall and other places, and if he got trapped standing there having to talk to people, you know, he'd hurry away as quick as he could. Now, when he was in front of people lecturing or giving discussions, he was very compassionate. He was very good at what he did, and he did a good job. But was he happy? No. And so I think the real difference I saw wasn't the kind of hypocrisy that you get in some of these mega Christian stars today who are living in 15,000-square-foot homes and driving jets around the country, who are really just ripping off people in the name of God. You know, my parents were nothing like that. Dad didn't even have a secretary when I was a little kid, and he worked on the corner of his bed out of a rocking chair on the coverlet of his bedspread, had absolutely nothing, never flew first class, didn't own a thing, gave all the royalties from his books in later years to Labrie Fellowship, was totally consistent and completely authentic in that sense. But where the difference came in is that I think that, you know, if he hadn't run into my mom and had her encouragement and her family's encouragement to get into the Lord's work, as they would call it, he could have had a very different life and probably a better life.
You think he might have been a labor leader or something like that?
Yeah, or in politics, or maybe an art historian. But an idea of being in a ministry where he was exposed to people day in, day out, and, you know, always somebody around. And, you know, when I would get up in the night to get a glass of milk from the refrigerator, I'd be stepping over sleeping bags, literally, because this was the 60s, and all these kids were in Europe, you know, trying to find themselves and hitchhiking to India and toing and froing and looking for truth and all the rest. It was sort of a commune before there were communes. And Dad was in the middle of this, you know, playing his music, trying to huddle away and be private and think and write and discuss with people, but I don't think enjoying himself very much. And was certainly a different guy when we went on hikes together. You know, one of the things I write about him in the book is just, you know, the affection that I had for my dad and my love for him when we were together in private, what a different kind of a person he was than when he had to be in public. And it was really, he was really a different persona. It was like night and day. And I think he suffered from depression a lot, and a lot of that was just brought on by having to be this public person because this was his vision of himself and also what my mom kind of pushed him into doing.
So do you think, having had the opportunity to look back on this, and your dad died in 1984.
Correct.
People who ultimately become fundamentalists of whatever particular set of beliefs, do you think that is an influence of culture and tradition, or do you think that's really just a temperament and that people who are fundamentalists might in fact have been fundamental in a different system of beliefs if that had been available to them?
Well, I think that's an excellent point you make. Really, really very incisive, and it's something I think about. I'm not sure. You know, when I look at my own personality and how my parents' views are stamped on me, I tend to go wholeheartedly into things. You know, I pursued a career as a writer since I was 39 and wrote my first novel, Portofino, and had gotten out of the movie business and kind of have done this whole hog, you know, produced these 10 books, and it's all I do. So in that sense, you know, yeah, I understand you get the bit between your teeth and you run, but I think some people are kind of born into a situation they don't choose, which is what I've been trying to sort out in Crazy for God, is what do I believe? What was I indoctrinated to believe? What are my views? What are views I inherited? And I used to think you could sort this out. I don't anymore. I think that, you know, if I'd been swapped at birth with one of my secular Jewish friends, you know, like Kathy Roth Duquette, that I wrote this book AWOL with a couple of years ago, maybe I'd have her views and she'd have mine. You know, who's to say? But I think that my mom was a fundamentalist by temperament. I mean, she was very, very intense. I think my dad wasn't. And I think for him, the struggle was that theoretically he believed this Calvinist theology. In practice, he didn't like it at all. And he would never be so annoyed as when somebody would show up at Labrie from places like Westminster Theological Seminary with a bunch of questions related to Calvinism, and he would deliberately ignore them in discussions and instead turn to artists and poets and other people who wanted to talk about music or what Bob Dylan's latest lyrics meant. That's what he wanted to talk about. I mean, he really disliked the theology. I've never seen more of an anti-theologian. He wanted to do the culture stuff. He didn't like it. And, of course, one of the tragedies was is at the end of his life, because of his reconnection with fundamentalism that he had kind of run away from in 1947 when he left America and went to Europe and founded Labrie, was that, you know, through the pro-life movement, these other things he got into, all of a sudden he was back in bed with all these right-wing crazy people like Jerry Falwell, who he disliked intensely, by the way, on a personal and intellectual level, and just felt was a fellow traveler that he had to do business with for the greater cause of the pro-life movement, as he saw it. But nevertheless, you know, it pulled him back into a firmament of activity that really left him very sad and depressed. And the last 6 years of his life before he died of cancer, you know, he was jetting around the country speaking for Falwell and Robertson and Dr. Dobson and all these people, and, you know, essentially hating every minute of it and wishing he could be back in Labrie. And, of course, a lot of that was my fault because I was this pushy, young, ambitious man who really got my dad into all this by making these film series and putting him on the road in these seminar tours that I organized. And, you know, essentially, I think I ruined his life. I think I ruined the last 6 or 7 years of his life. And I hope that Crazy for God, if it does nothing else, in a way, redeem some of that by showing that my dad was a much more complex and nuanced and interesting and deep person than the religious right that kind of borrowed him the way popes borrow Mother Teresa to take pictures with her during her lifetime, rescue him a little bit from that fate, because I helped get him into that, and I hope the book, in a way, extricates him.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You, for moral and also personal reasons, became really opposed to abortion.
Right.
And decided that this should be an issue that you took around the world, and in fact back to the U.S.
Right.
And then some of the allies you made started to realize the power that your father had and what
right.
that could do for them. Can you talk about that process?
Well, it's like everything else. You slip into things before you think about it. And working backwards, you know, let me just put it this way, just to be blunt about it, you know, for anybody who's unhappy with George W. Bush as president, they can partly thank Dad and I for having energized the evangelical movement in the late 70s and early 80s that gave the Republicans dominance for 30 years and gave us this presidency. And what happened was we got into something that we felt was a religious and moral cause that soon took on political dimensions and overtones and was very much manipulated and abused and used by people who didn't really do anything about abortion one way or the other, but raised an awful lot of money based on these issues. And then also became power figures, people like Dr. Dobson, who seems to revel in having the Republican Party kowtow to him, a man who single-handedly helped other people derail, for instance, John McCain's 2000 campaign and gave us Bush instead, based on the fact that McCain would simply not kiss up to these religious right figures who were so used to the power circles of Republicanism kissing up to them. And you know, so Dad and I launched that. And I think, looking back myself, my own views have changed pretty dramatically, which I talk about in Crazy for God. And that is that, you know, I got Jeannie, my wife of 37 years, pregnant when I was 17 and she was 18, and we got married. And, you know, I have no clue who those kids were back then, but I know that I love her now and we're still together, thank God. However, having said that, you know, as I looked at my little daughter, Jessica, and now I look at my granddaughter, Amanda, and I realize that these, you know, are unwanted children in a way, if you follow that abortion logic, it set my teeth on edge because they gave a great deal, and my daughter gave a great deal of meaning to my life. But when you look at the politics of it, as I write about in the book, it's a different matter. That politics has been used and abused by right-wing Christians and right-wing political leaders and the Republican Party in a very cynical way. That has nothing to do with helping unborn children and everything to do with getting yourself elected in politics. And really, you know, my own view now, and I'm not hesitant to say so, is that I still think abortion is a sad thing and a tragedy. And I think in some cases it should be legal and in other cases illegal. And that really doesn't please anybody. But I also finished that sentence in Crazy for God by saying, and I could be wrong about that view. And that's the difference. You know, when I was in my fundamentalist phase, I never finished any sentence saying, yeah, and I could be wrong. You know, whether it came to fighting with my wife and being more of an SOB than I needed to be or am now because I was so determined to be right about everything, or whether it came to, you know, big political statements. And I think that's the difference between fundamentalists and other people, and that is other people may have strong views, but finish the sentence saying, I could be wrong. There may be another point of view. There may be something I don't know here. You know, and I think that's the shift for me. It isn't, you know, having adopted wholesale another point of view or become liberal or conservative or left-wing or right-wing. It's just, hey, I could be wrong. There are things that I don't know. In fact, most things I don't know. Maybe life's too short to know anything. Maybe faith is a matter of hope and not certainty. These are the ways I feel now, and I certainly didn't before.
Frank Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called Crazy for God. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hello, Chris. Thank you so much for having Mr. Schaefer on. Mr. Schaefer, I'm a former fundamentalist, and in the kind of later years of my fundamentalist phase, I read a book called A Time for Anger, which I believe, was that written by your father?
That was by me back in my bad old days.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that book had a big influence on the pastor of my church, and we were very much embroiled in the whole anti-abortion movement at that time, and a gentleman named Flip Benham, who now heads Operation Rescue, was very much part of our little scene there. And, yeah, you kind of just answered my question. I was going to ask if your father had written that book later in his life when he was terminally ill. But let me frame the question this way. Do you think your father, in struggling with terminal illness, do you think he did become more angry and strident there toward the end? And do you think that may have influenced his writings at all? And also, just a follow-up question on that, have you, you know, pondered the possibility that some of these folks that have actually killed abortion practitioners may have been inspired by your writings? And I'll just close with: have you read the writings of Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins? And if not, I highly recommend them to you.
David,
well, thank you so much for your
questions.
Call.
Sort of work back. Yes. I haven't read Harris, but of course I've read Dawkins. In terms of people getting killed, yeah, I think the abortion movement went off the anti-abortion movement went off the rails, and that some of the hysteria that was there was probably contributed to by the film series that I did with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Surgeon General, and with my father and some of those other books. There's no way to know, but there's no reason to believe they weren't, and I can't duck that. So I think, yes, that's part of it. When it gets back to the kind of anger question, I think that, you know, what happened was to my father was this, and that is, you know, he came out of this mission in Switzerland, the Brie that he had been in, and found himself working with people that would have never come to Le Brie, because Le Brie was a place that welcomed all sorts of people, gay people, black people, white people, men, women. It was very, very progressive in terms of the way it dealt with human beings and what issues it looked at as important and what weren't. And all of a sudden, Dad went from that over this one issue to working with people like Dr. Dobson and others. And I think he, frankly, was just numbed and horrified by the end and really became disillusioned in a way. When it comes to the anger, I think I was very shrill, very hysterical, off the wall, totally in the grip of a kind of an ego trip combined with absolute sort of blood in your eye, certainty that we were right, everybody else was wrong. And of course, to be a little bit fair to us and other people, our opponents, when it was in those early days of the pro-life movement, were pretty fist in your face too. I mean, you know, the abortion proponents were want to deride people for taking an opposite view and kind of call them misogynistic or barbarians. The lines were pretty stark on all sides, and we were very much part of that. But I look back not only with regret for what was said, but also the tone. And, you know, I hope Crazy for God goes a long way toward doing several things, but one of them is just to give people hope that, you know, idiots like me can grow and change and be different, so that we don't write each other off so quickly, because, you know, someone can grow up a little bit and change, and I hope that that journey is something that I trace in Crazy for God in a way that will let people know that, you know, even people who write books with titles like A Time for Anger can wind up in late middle age, maybe a little wiser and a little more peaceful in the way they look at things.
One of the things you've said that appeals to you about the Greek Orthodox Church is the ability to go to confession. Can
Correct.
You talk about that? That's very different from the evangelical tradition. Can you talk
Yes.
about how you sort of discovered that that would be a comfort to you?
Well, I stumbled into the Orthodox Church after I'd completely left evangelical Christianity. And it was a great relief to find the sacraments that didn't depend on this kind of man-made celebrity culture where it's all about the pastor and his family, but rather just these sacraments that go on with whoever's the priest. One of them's confession, and it's sort of free psychological counseling, if you want to put it that way, but with someone telling you you've been forgiven at the end of it. And to me personally, this sacrament has been a great gift.
Frank Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called Crazy for God. We'll return to the conversation after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, offering gift certificates for anyone on your list who loves the arts, languages, writing, history, or travel. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Frank Schaefer. His newest book is called Crazy for God. It's a memoir of his childhood as the son of Edith and Francis Schaefer. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I have to say, Frank, one of the most moving points in the book for me was when you realized that you really couldn't do this anymore, and your personal beliefs were very different from what you were espousing in public, but you had a mortgage and three kids to feed and people who depended on you and the income that you were making from this life that you had created for yourself. Can you talk about that time and how you were able to sort of finally break away from the only thing you had ever said publicly about the way you felt?
Yeah, it was obviously a time of crisis of both faith and practically, because if you're going to kiss it all goodbye and you're running around getting paid to speak at the National Religious Broadcasters and all the rest of it, it's a tough decision. But what happened to me wasn't so much a moral crisis, it's just that I couldn't go any further. It wasn't just, you know, how do you look at yourself in the mirror when you're saying things you don't believe? It was practically, how do you do something that every fiber in your body is basically telling you not to do? And I had almost an allergic reaction. So my solution was to try to get into the legitimate, if you want to put it that way, or secular film business. And I went out to Hollywood and used the reel that I cut from the documentaries I had made with my father to get some jobs. I made four very poor, mediocre Hollywood movies, Wired to Kill, Baby on Board with Judge Reinhold and Carol Kane, sort of instant-to-video type things for ABC, this sort of thing. In no way art or anything, you know, that I aspired to make. Realized that this wasn't going so well. Wrote this novel, Portofino, that then led to the Calvin Becker trilogy of Saving Grandma and Zermatt. But also went broke because I just kind of refused to go any further. And so we had this company called Schaefer Productions, which actually raised quite a bit of money in the Dallas area from people like the Hunt brothers and Mary Crowley and others who were big figures in your town and back in the day. And we had put the money together for Whatever Happened to the Human Race with my dad and Dr. Koop, and were, you know, several million dollars a year coming in, small change compared to the big-time Christians today. But nevertheless, plenty to make the movies we were making. And we just shut the doors. In fact, sent back all the envelopes to donors unopened for the last round of fundraising, and people just were staggered. It was like, well, where did these guys go? You know, here one minute, gone the next. And where I was out in Hollywood making bad movies, eventually going broke, having a kind of a breakdown where I actually got to a point where I was shoplifting pork chops, stuffing them into my pants and running out of Ralph's Grocery to try to get some protein because I was living off what they call the craft service cart, which is the sort of donuts and cereal on movie sets in an editing suite where I was editing this crummy movie, Baby on Board. And, you know, my life was literally coming apart. We weren't actually as bad off as I thought we were. It's just I was embarrassed to ask my wife, who was in Massachusetts with the kids, to send me money. And these were low-budget, real fiasco kind of films. But, you know, as I put in the book, if it was a choice between going to jail for shoplifting or being an evangelical leader, I'd rather do time. And I'm not being facetious. I'm being serious about that. I just couldn't do the other because I realized it was utterly fraudulent and ridiculous for me to do something I didn't believe. After that, in a long period in the desert, you know, of this kind of traveling around, somewhere in the midst of that, I began to find out about Orthodoxy. And just at that time of crisis, that same couple of years, began to go to an Orthodox church and eventually went into it. And, of course, Orthodox spirituality is very different because it isn't this sort of born again, once saved, always saved. It looks at spirituality as a journey. You're somewhere on the path or you aren't. But it was very different than what I had known. And I guess the big difference was it's not based on a celebrity culture of mega churches or anything like this. It's just the old liturgies that have been there for 1,600 years or more, and you do or you don't do that. And so it came as a relief, but I haven't sorted out all my problems. People who read Crazy for God will see that I'm still on a journey. There's plenty of days I don't believe anything. I'm kind of an agnostic when it comes to those things. At the same time, go to church and find my way along. But a lot more peace in my life, a much better relationship with my wife and my three kids and grandchildren than I ever had when I was doing my evangelical work, which was fraught with all kinds of disquiet. And, you know, it's been a long, long, crazy road, and that's what the book is about.
You said that it's much easier to leave behind your parents' faith intellectually than it is to move away from those gut instincts that still linger from your
right.
days as an evangelical. When do you feel that most intensely?
I feel that most intensely at my emotional reaction to things that has nothing to do with logic or what I believe. But, you know, when it comes to morals, for instance, in my head, you know, I'm much more tolerant than I am when I just read a story about something that they would have disagreed with. Or when it comes to, you know, believing the Bible, when I think about it, I understand, of course, that, you know, the Bible may or may not be the word of God, depending on your point of view. But obviously, this whole business about inerrancy and every word being true is just nonsense. I mean, even just translating from Greek and Hebrew into English involves error for anybody who knows anything about publishing, let alone the larger issues of, you know, what stories you believe, what are mythological, what are kind of metaphors for other things, all that kind of discussion. But, you know, my knee-jerk reaction is still, you know, much further to the right than my head is. My kind of view of things and other people, quick to judge, and then I have to remind myself that I'm not there anymore. And I just think it comes in those sort of flash reactions, you know, that have been bred into me. And then, you know, I have to consider a little longer and think, yeah, but that's not who I am, and that's not what I really believe. And, you know, this is just my reaction. I mean, it's like an allergic reaction, but it doesn't mean that I'm married to that allergy.
Frank Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called Crazy for God. Let's go next to Carla in Dallas. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Thank you for being on, Mr. Schaefer, and thank you for having him on. My question for you is, I guess I sort of relate with you as I'm a pastor's daughter, a fundamentalist pastor's daughter, and have recently gone through several of the changes that I've heard you talk about as well, and kind of feel like I'm trying to rebuild some sort of faith, but also a little bit fearful to leave the faith that I know,
right.
But not able to exist in it any longer. My question for you is kind of a personal one, actually, because I recently had a daughter, and my concern with my leaving my faith behind is what do I teach her and how do I teach her to have some sort of spirituality and some sort of faith without putting her through some of the things you described earlier
right.
in the conversation about being taught that the fate of that people's eternal destiny is in her hands and that even her eternal destiny is so, I don't know, those kinds of things. I just wondered, since your children were young, when you had some of these changes, how you dealt with that with your children and what kind of things you feel you did well and what kind of things you would change if you could go back, just to
right.
sort of guide me, I guess, a little bit.
Carla, thank you so much for your call.
Sure.
Good questions, and, you know, all the best with your child. You know, obviously I don't have the wisdom to really answer you, but I'll give a stab at it. And that is, I think the beginning is that you tell your children the truth. And I know that sounds obvious, but that includes sharing your own doubts and fears. And that includes telling them what you hope to believe, what you really believe, what you're not sure about, rather than feeding them a kind of a pat, nailed-down, propagandistic line that you feel you need to tell them. In other words, tell them the truth, and tell them the truth as they ask questions as best you can. Obviously, with little kids, it can't be overcomplicated. The second thing, I think, is be willing to listen to them and not always have this agenda that somehow their little dark souls need saving, and that, you know, you've got to weasel in a little message with everything, this pietistic, annoying thing where nothing can just be a good day. It's always got to be God teaching us something through the sunset or a little moralistic lesson. You know, this eventually drives kids crazy and further away from anything reasonable. And then I think third, last for yourself, you know, if you have a spiritual hunger, follow it. You know, I'm a spiritual person. The last thing I'm doing is trying to talk people into being atheists. But follow it, you know, where you're truly comfortable. And for instance, for me, you know, I go to a Greek Orthodox church. Okay, part of that may be that I'm convinced, but I think a lot of it is just psychological. It's far enough away from what I was raised with, so I don't get goosebumps when I walk in and hear things that have all sorts of negative connotations for me. Part of it is it's just fresh and new. So be willing to look for some spirituality outside of the beaten path. I mean, take a look at the Orthodox Church. Take a look at a Roman Catholic Church. You know, maybe go to some place that you would have thought of as quote-unquote liberal before. You know, talk to different people. But I think when it comes to our kids, if we tell them the truth about what we really think, rather than what we think they ought to hear when it comes to the questions of God and belief and faith, we can get a long way down the road, and, you know, you wind up as friends with your kids. I mean, this is a great privilege. Rather than the relationship being, you know, pastor and people, they're your friends. And I've done a lot of things wrong with my kids, and I talk about that in Crazy for God. I was way too strict with my daughter. I used to slap her when she was little, kind of preach at her. And, you know, Jessica has forgiven me. We had tears, and we had a time of forgiveness, and you can get back the years that you waste in a way. You know, God's merciful that way, but there's no need to start out that way. And I think part of that strictness with me came from this tension of trying to, quote, do the right thing and raise my kids right. Don't worry about raising your kids right. Just worry about enjoying them as human beings and let them enjoy you really for who you are. And that includes somebody with doubts and fears, and I think you'll be okay.
Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I've really been intrigued by the conversation with Frank Jr. I'm a former pastor, kind of in a career change, and read his father's works earlier on. I really enjoyed them, and as well had the same misgivings about how some evangelicals used the material. Was disappointed in the shrillness of them. I'm still an evangelical, but hopefully I've grown beyond that. I just wanted to say thank you for your openness and your vulnerability. And I trust that evangelicals do grow and get out of their autogata and into more flexible attitudes toward dialogue. I just wondered, have you been able to maintain some contact with evangelicals that are a little bit more reasonable than previous evangelicals that you had contact with?
Yes, I have, actually. I hear regularly from Richard Cizik, who's the vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, who likes my recent book and contacted me and, in fact, referred a Wall Street Journal reporter to me a few weeks ago in an article they were doing on environmental issues from an evangelical point of view, saying, well, if you want to hear something different, you know, talk to Frank Schaefer about his views. So, yeah, there's plenty of people in the evangelical world that wish that the earth would open and swallow me right now, I think. And there are some others who just won't, you know, acknowledge that I'm still around, who used to be my friends. But then there's people like Richard who I think are open and looking forward and are very much evangelical, and probably I don't agree with on a lot of things, but we're talking like human beings, like people who, you know, are open to other human beings. So, yes, I don't find the evangelical group to be monolithic or speaking with one voice. There's a lot of individuals in there with a lot of good things to say.
Frank, is faith threatened by unanswerable questions, or does it require them?
Well, let's put it this way. I think faith is threatened by anybody who says there aren't unanswerable questions, because that means that they have adopted the position of fanaticism and stupidity. I mean, anyone who can get out there at night and look up at the universe and realize there's only 25 miles of breathable air above us and then nothing, and that, you know, our last record of divine intervention in a Christian sense is, you know, 2,000 some years ago in Palestine, and we're holding on grimly to that point of reference and not come away with a few questions or doubts, is really a lunatic or has deluded themselves to the point where whatever they believe is something that nobody wants to know about who's a little more thoughtful. So I'd put it the other way around. I would say the only way to have faith is to have doubts just about everything and to question them. And that's why I have faith, because this longing to know something, this longing for some spirituality in one's life, this longing for unanswered meaning is like the feeling that some of the amputees who fought with my son in Iraq who have lost their legs tell me about, that they have in their legs, these phantom feelings of legs. Well, where do these phantom feelings of longing for meaning come from if there is no meaning out there? So to me, it's the other way around. The very fact that we question, to me, gives me hope rather than fear. And I think it's a sad thing that fundamentalism goes the other way and doesn't want to question, because really what that does is shuts the door to real faith and just replaces it with sort of conditioning. And, of course, that doesn't last when you grow up and get away from it or question. And that's why there's so many people wandering around out there who feel they've had to choose between faith and nothing, when actually there's a better alternative, and that is to embrace the questions.
Frank Schaefer's new book is called Crazy for God: How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. Frank, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Hey, Chris, thanks so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.